From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Jeremy, as you know, we've been following the aftermath of yesterday's terrible flooding in Texas. Many families were at graduation ceremonies last night when they got flash flood alerts on their cell phones. A prom queen was killed driving home from an event. People are saying it all just happened so fast.
And the flood warnings continue in parts of Texas where flash floods have forced evacuations, left thousands of residents without electricity. The floods caused by heavy rain and thunderstorms. There have been tornadoes reported. In Texas and Oklahoma, already at least five people are dead. Many more are missing. Mary Jane Marmolejo told CNN that she and her family woke up to ankle-deep floodwaters rushing into their home.
Animals went running everywhere. It was like the scariest thing I've ever seen. I've never seen it so high, the water. But in a matter of like 2 to 3 minutes, the water was from ankles to your knees.
In Houston, Mayor Anise Parker has declared a state of emergency. In parts of that city, you need a boat to get around today. Emergency officials there say they responded to 968 calls for help since midnight. 531 were water rescues. Joining us now from Houston is Jay Bostic, who's been dealing with the rain there. And Jay, what is it like in Houston right now?
Right now, it's actually pretty nice. The sun's come out. I want to say it's drying up, but if you see any part of the bayous, it still looks a bit of a mess. The weather says that we're going to have some more rain coming, so I'm a little nervous for what's to come. But for now, it's okay.
Well, and as you look outside of your house, do you see water everywhere, or what does it look like?
So I'm in a residential neighborhood that's actually just outside of downtown. In my direct street and probably the few streets that surround me, no. However, I work about a mile and a half from our home, and I drove over there today, and all of that is completely underwater. My parking garage is underwater. Hmm. You can't even get into my office building.
And what about getting around? Could you go to work if you wanted to today?
I could kayak there, but I don't think that I could get there. No. We woke up this morning to alerts from both the school district. So we have a five-year-old, and all of Houston Independent School District has closed all of their schools, as have the surrounding school districts as well. So that was first. And then we got both emails and text messages from work saying, due to the deluge of rain, they were closing their doors.
Have you ever experienced anything like this before in Houston? You are a native Houstonian.
I am. You know, I remember as a kid growing up in the early 80s, it seemed like every year there being a flood. Hurricane Alicia was in 83, and then Tropical Storm Francis was at the end of my high school in the late 90s. And so Houston has always had a flooding problem, and in my opinion, a problem with infrastructure related to that. So this isn't something new. I think what was different about this was that we had warnings that it was going to rain all weekend, and everybody was canceling Memorial Day plans. Barbecues got canceled. Birthday parties got canceled. And it never came. And then last night, we all went to bed and just massive, massive rains hit. And it seems like it came out of nowhere.
Well, and for some people, we read the stories about some of these people who they're in cabins and they just float away. And it seems to happen out of nowhere. Are you worried for your own safety or the safety of your family that maybe something you're not expecting could happen that as a result of these floods could put you in danger?
I am actually. The flooding that you're referencing is happening up in the Texas Hill Country, which is near Austin. That's right. About 2.5 hours from Houston. Almost all of my family, with the exception of my parents, live in the Hill Country. And so we are worried about that. Houston is a little more flat, so we get less of those mudslides and things like that that would sweep a house away, per se. What I'm more worried about is we had so much lightning last night, and I know there were a few houses that caught on fire. So I think that's the worry for me right now is, are we facing more lightning?
And what are you hearing from local officials? Are they warning you about going out at this point?
You know, the mayor was on the news this morning, and she did speak to us about only getting out if absolutely necessary. But with the exception of that one press junket from our mayor, I haven't heard anything, actually. It's been rather – most of the information we're getting is just from the local news stations.
That's Jay Bostic of Houston. Jay, best of luck to you and your family.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Congress isn't scheduled to return to Washington from its current recess until sometime in June, but lawmakers are being called back Sunday for a vote on reauthorizing the Patriot Act and a very key provision having to do with domestic surveillance. What other unfinished business did Congress leave behind? Let's bring in Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. And Ron, I hope you had a reflective Memorial Day.
Yes, a lovely weekend here in Washington and a lovely time to reflect.
Time to reflect. Well, and most Americans back to work, Congress being called back. So remind us where we are on the Patriot Act and an upcoming deadline, I believe June 1st.
That's right, and that's next Monday. So Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, is bringing the Senate back early, 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon, for what will be a highly dramatic session, one suspects. Mitch McConnell and the Senate hawks, if you will, on the Republican side, really want to keep the bulk collection of telephone data that the National Security Agency has been performing under the Patriot Act for most of the last dozen years or so. And this is something that is highly controversial, even within the state of Kentucky's Republican Party, because Rand Paul is leading the opposition. So we have a lot of votes lined up against that extension. It does not look as though the leader is going to be able to get it. So they'll have a vote then on the House-passed version.
Right. And if I've got this right, the people who want the provision to stay in the Patriot Act say that this is just collection of phone calls. You don't hear content. You don't know who's made them. Those against it say that you can see patterns and they worry about personal security that way. So what do you think is going to happen?
There appear to be only a few votes lacking to pass in the Senate what the House has already agreed to, and what I should add, the Obama administration has also agreed to, which is a set of reforms that would greatly scale back what the NSA has been collecting, but still give them the ability to go after certain kinds of phone call records when they can show a pattern or when they can show something that connects it to terrorist activity outside this country.
Yeah. And another piece of unfinished business has to do with international trade. Now, I know we've spoken about this, but a weekend has a way of wiping out any memory of these things. So remind us, on Friday, the Senate approved President Obama's Fast-Track Trade Promotion Authority bill. Worth going over. Remind us what that is.
Yes, it gives the president, any president really, the authority to negotiate with other countries some kind of trade arrangements and then bring that treaty back for an up or down vote from Congress. Still has to be approved in Congress, but Congress cannot amend it in its details.
Yeah, just say yes
or
no. They
have to just go up or down, yes.
Yeah. And so where are we on that?
The Senate has passed it, so here we flip the coin from the situation on the Patriot Act, because here the conflict lies in the House. And in the House, the Republican Party is primarily in favor of this kind of trade authority for presidents, but a minority within that party, about 40 to 45 members, don't want to give it to this particular president. They want to wait until the Obama presidency is over, if then. Some of them have problems with this kind of trade authority anyway. So that's a big block to lose out of the majority. They need to make that up with Democratic votes. They're going to need about 20 as a minimum to get the bill over and give the president this authority. That is to say 20 Democrats. And the bill is very unpopular among line Democrats because the base of the Democratic Party, particularly labor unions, object to the trade agreements that come out of this authority. Not so much the authority for the president per se, but they object to the trade agreements themselves. They say it costs jobs in the United States.
Right. And this is the charge that's being led by the Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is the split in the Democratic Party. But it's all about, not just as you say, you know, the bill itself is about the president's authority, but it has to do with the Trans-Pacific trade deal and whether or not he's going to be able to apply this authority to that. What's your thinking looking ahead at that?
The Trans-Pacific deal is the real deal right now. It's the thing that people are talking about, and it affects countries in Asia, South America, and North America. But down the road, there are also more agreements coming with the European Union, and some people are more focused there if that's where they see their competition. So there are a lot of other side issues attaching themselves at this point, including currency manipulation, which is something that concerns a lot of Democrats, a lot of Republicans. They see some of our trading partners playing games with their currency valuations that hurt our exports and boost the imports of our competitors. So they want to see that dealt with in this bill. The administration doesn't want to touch that. They don't want to have that included in this entire negotiation. So that, too, is a wrinkle that is making this more difficult. In the end, though, you have the leadership of both parties in the Senate, and now in the House, you have the leadership of the Republican Party, which is in charge. They and their committee chairs want this to go through, even though it's something that President Obama wants. So ultimately, it would seem that the planets will align, and maybe with just the absolute bare minimum of votes, they'll get this through in the House next week or the week after.
Well, Ron, we have about a minute here. I want you to touch on the words over the weekend from Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who said that Iraqi forces showed no will to fight against ISIS in the takeover, ISIS's takeover of Ramadi. Vice President Joe Biden seemed to have to smooth that out. He called Iraq's prime minister to try to smooth it over. We're hearing reports today that Iraqis are launching an assault on ISIS in Ramadi. But putting that aside, just your sense of the politics there.
A bit of the tough cop, nice cop routine appears to be in play here. Ash Carter sounded a little like Captain Obvious, saying that those Iraqi forces that cleared out so fast from Ramadi had not shown much of a will to fight. They had numerical superiority. They might not necessarily have outgunned the ISIS forces, however, who are using quite a bit of equipment that they've captured from the Iraqis that was eventually or was originally U.S. military equipment. And then along comes Joe Biden to be nice and say, oh, no, we really didn't mean to insult the courage or the manhood of the Iraqi forces. We expect them to recapture Ramadi, and we're all for you. Let's have a pep rally.
Well, it may have had an effect. We'll see what's happening today. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Are you in the mood for a good story, one with a happy ending? Oh, good, because we happen to have one. It's about how an old-fashioned ship captain's bell and high-tech proton beam radiation combine to fight cancer.
Hi, Robin, how are you?
Our story starts at Boston's Mass General Hospital last February, where we met Lars Gerfast and his 12-year-old son, David, two sturdy, hoodie-clad Minnesotans who'd been told by doctors there at the Lahey Clinic to get to Boston fast to treat the remnants of David's rare form of cancer, chordoma. Unfortunately, David is the hugest Seattle Seahawks fan. They'd just been beaten by the Patriots in the Super Bowl. On the bright side, he's a huge Bruins fan, and those players had just visited. Oh, did you meet some Bruins today?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, look at that. You got all sorts of Bruins stuff.
I'm a big Bruins fan.
Cool. Awesome.
I mean, they're my favorite hockey team.
Oh, great. Oh, great. That makes up for Tom Brady. I am really sorry that you have to be here on post-Super Bowl week. You know, it could have been the Seahawks.
Yeah, it should have been.
Oh.
Easily.
Well, we sat down to talk. So how are you doing?
Good.
How would you explain what's happening?
Well, I'm out here. Have proton beam radiation for my tumor that all the cells and stuff that are still in there.
What, proton radiation? That sounds like transponders.
It's kind of cool.
It's like a video game or something. I mean, what are the protons doing?
Just coming in and not exiting. Just coming in.
To battle the bad cells.
Yeah.
Do I understand that you discovered that you had this cancer after a tackle?
Mm-hmm. I snapped the ball and somebody grabbed my face mask. And I hurt my back, and then got an MRI, and then they found the tumor.
Yeah. I bet that's the only time you are thrilled that you got tackled by the face mask.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. We were very happy because he had no symptoms at all. The tumor was removed. Unfortunately, it was wrapped around his vertebral artery, so they weren't able to take it out in one piece. You know, they said, you get the cells radiated right away.
How is it? I mean, you've been uprooted too.
Yeah, but whatever it takes.
I have treatment for 8 weeks, and then I'll get MRIs every 3 to 6 months. That's pretty much all I know about what's going to happen. I mean, I've been being as positive as possibly can. It's hard without my mom and my sisters here, but my dad and I are getting through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's very strong. Yeah. He's always, through this whole thing, he's been very, very strong. But, he has his moments where he breaks down, and this is going to be a long process. These chordoma cells, they will come back, and he'll have to watch it his whole life.
There's a tradition here. I don't know, does David even know about the tradition here at the end of treatment?
Yeah, it's like when the last day of your treatment, you get to ring the bell.
Are you looking forward to ringing it?
Yeah.
And a big smile?
Yeah.
What will that mean for you?
It'll make me feel really good inside that I was able to beat this and go home.
It's very hard for him to be away from his sisters. They're very close.
Yeah, I can see. Yeah, I'm sorry, David. It's hard. You know what? We'll come back and we'll record the whole thing so that they can hear it.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Think of that bell, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you doing?
Yeah. So, fast forward to April. David's treatment has been very, very tough. We meet him in the proton beam radiation office for his last one. His mom, Cindy Gersak, has arrived from Minnesota. His dad, Lars, is here, as he's been for 8 weeks. David looks a little beat. His throat is sore and beat up. Was it tougher than you thought?
A little.
How excited are you about the last treatment coming up?
Not able to take it to words.
It's not able to take it to words? There you go.
Yeah.
Very.
Yep.
Yeah, it's overwhelming at some degree just because of the emotions of having completed the 43 treatments.
And 43?
Yeah, 43 treatments.
So what happens now, Dad?
Go home.
The small waiting room is packed. There's 20-something Candace and her mom, Shelley. They're from Canada. Candace is fighting the same rare form of cancer.
I met David a couple weeks ago. He's been my boyfriend for the last 2 weeks. I'm actually here to watch David ring the bell today. I'm very excited for him.
What does that mean to you?
I've watched him in some pretty low moments, you know, not feeling very good, and I am really proud of him. He's come a long way.
And then there's Ann Caldwell, who drove up from Martha's Vineyard. Her 9-year-old daughter finished her treatments the day before. So they supported you and your daughter, and you're here to support them?
Yes. They crawled out of bed very early to come see Samantha ring the bell yesterday.
What did that mean to you?
It's hard to do this alone. It was great. It was great. Yeah.
So, a community has grown here. While Mom Cindy was mostly back in Minnesota, I asked her how hard it was to be away.
It's terrible. I mean, we have two younger daughters, 9 and 4, and pets, and it's just a huge support system back at home, but they're not here. And so it was just Dad and David and having to pull the weight there, and then I pulled the weight at home with the girls. Thank goodness for Skype. But it's not the same.
No, David's shaking his head like no.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy, 15 minutes.
Here you go.
Last one, huh? Yep. Excited?
He's going in.
He's going in. There he goes, his last time.
What exactly happens?
Well, they put this mesh mask on his face and then lock him into the table.
Oh.
And then he can't move.
Can't move.
And then there's this proton beam radiation. Then he's done. And then today he actually gets to take his mask with him.
It's like a hockey mask.
It's kind of cool.
Cindy and I make idle chatter while we wait for David to finish his last treatment. But, of course, there's no such thing as idle chatter in a cancer treatment waiting room. Cindy talks about the stories nurses have told her about how great her burly 12-year-old has been.
He has been a help to all these other little guys like Mac. And he would play trains and trucks with him every morning. And he would always want David. David, where's David? And so, yeah, so they came back for Max ringing of his bell, too. And
it becomes a real community.
It does. It does. You really build these bonds.
And by the way, your eyes have been full.
Oh, it's going to be a tear wash. I lost my mom to cancer when I was 12. So. And her anniversary of her death is October 27th. And that was the day we were supposed to meet with the surgeon the first time. To hear his results. And I had told them that when they did the biopsy, I said, if they're going to tell me my son has cancer on the day my mom died from it, I can't hear it. So they called us that Friday before on the 24th. And he's going to beat it. He's going to win. He's going to win.
How much does having that ceremony count?
Well, it's just a completion. It's feeling the sense of, oh, I made it. I'm done. You know, and there's a really nice little poem written over by the bell that really kind of says it all. I've conquered this moment.
Yeah.
Yay, he's here.
David's out, followed by a gaggle of nurses and doctors. He unfurls a certificate of completion and then marches straight to the big captain's bell hanging on the wall.
The rules of ringing the bell, you got to read the poem and then you can ring it.
Really loud.
Look at that sound.
Ring this bell three times well. It's told will clearly say, my treatments are done, this course is run, and now I'm on my way.
I'll take one with you.
Staff and family crowd to take pictures. David is presented with a gift from the nursing team.
That was all hard work, energy, the sweat.
Yeah.
That's you, right?
Pretty much.
That was you. So a little gift card from NHL.com.
Whoa.
All right.
All right.
Everything you hoped, David?
Yeah. It's hard to explain. Just amazing. Felt like the biggest accomplishment I could have had.
All done. Now we can go home. That was basically the goal.
Get it done.
And you just went through this yesterday with your own daughter and seemed maybe as many tears today. I mean, what's that like for you?
I actually think I had more tears today. Yesterday I was still in mom mode of, you know, soldiering. Today I can finally let go.
This is such an important ritual.
Yeah, it is.
So I wonder if it's more for the parents.
Probably.
Congratulations. Get home safely, please.
And then find me on Facebook or I'll find you.
So yep, we can keep in Lars contact. And I have, yeah.
His Minnesota doctors always said David did well because he was so goal-oriented, so that bell must have been like a goalpost for him. We talked to Cindy Gerfest today. She said David's doing great. He plans on painting his radiation mask Spider-Man colors and wearing it at Halloween. But Dad Lars, a contractor, came home to find his job gone. His company hopes to be able to rehire him. The Gerfests are all grateful for the support of friends and a bell.
With every second that ticks by,
the future is running out.
That's George Clooney in Disney's Tomorrowland, and if you don't recognize it, that's probably because you didn't see it like most Americans. Tomorrowland opened to a weak reception over the Memorial Day weekend, bringing the overall box office numbers down with it. According to data from the media research company RentTrack, the weekend was Hollywood's slowest Memorial Day since 2001. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal is with us from New York with more on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this was the number one movie at the box office. There wasn't a lot of competition, but it did not do well. Why such a bad weekend at the box office?
A bad weekend at the box office. And, you know, typically the fourth weekend of May is one of the biggest of the year for the movie industry. And this year, the estimated take between Friday and Monday was $190 million. And, you know, this is particularly bad considering that the average ticket price since 2001 has risen 44% over that time. Tomorrowland was the sole new big budget movie, and it misfired for Disney.
And why? What was wrong with it? Or what was wrong with all movies right now? Why isn't anybody going?
Well, let's speak about Tomorrowland in particular. I mean, this was a rare attempt by Disney to spend a lot of money on a movie that didn't feature characters or, you know, a fictional world that was already known to audiences. They spent $180 million on this film. And what Disney's saying, you know, in the aftermath of this weekend is that they think parents are waiting to hear from other parents about this, since parents didn't know anything about these characters, and so they want to hear, and they're hoping for good word of mouth to improve things in coming weeks, and that, you know, the hope is that also for families that there isn't much else out there in the next few weeks. There isn't a new PG-rated movie until Disney's own Inside Out from Pixar Animation Studios comes out June 19th. But, you know, it's a tough business going into films that don't already have a built-in audience. You know, the recent success for Disney's really been with live-action adaptations of classics, like right. Maleficent. That's based on Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella.
Now, what about past Memorial Days? Let's put this in the context. How do the past Memorial Day weekends at the box office compare?
Okay, well, you know, Tomorrowland, again, it brought only $40 million. So that was the big movie of the weekend. And, right. and you know, it actually barely beat Pitch Perfect, which came out the weekend before, and that grossed $38 million over 4 days. Now, last year, X-Men Days of Future Past, that grossed $110 million on Memorial Day weekend. Again, compare that to $40 million for Tomorrowland. And then the year before that, it was Fast and Furious 6, and that opened to $97 million. So it's really that, you know, that tentpost movie for Memorial Day weekend that gets people out to the box offices.
So any ray of light at the end of the tunnel here for Hollywood?
Well, Hollywood has high hopes for the rest of the summer. Some of the movies that are coming out that have potential to draw big audiences include Jurassic World,
right. That's gonna be big.
Terminator, Genesis, and then another Mission Impossible. Those always tend to do pretty well. Rogue Nation is the one that's coming out this summer, and The Despicable Me, which is a spinoff of Minions. Hmm.
Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal. You didn't see Tomorrowland, did you? Jason?
I was not in that small percentage.
That's okay.
Of people who
actually
saw that
one. No, you and everybody else. Jason, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Humorist Simon Rich's book Spoiled Brats is out today in paperback. Rich is a former Saturday Night Live writer. He's also the creator of the FXX show Man Seeking Woman, which has been picked up for a second season. It centers around a young man named Josh whose dating misadventures verge on the surreal, like in this scene where he finds out about his ex's new boyfriend.
Who is he?
This guy Adolf.
His name is Adolf? Like Adolf Hitler?
Oh, cool, you know him.
I thought he died like years ago.
Nah, he faked that.
It's a kind of humor that makes its way into Simon Rich's short stories as well. In Spoiled Brats, which again is out today in paperback, we meet privileged characters thrust into bizarre situations. When I spoke with Simon Rich about the book in October, he started by telling us about one of the stories called Sellout, which had a particularly personal connection.
Sellout is it's pretty autobiographical. The main character is my great-great-grandfather, Herschel Rich. In the story, he comes through Ellis Island as a dirt-poor immigrant in the early 20th century, and he has a real hard-scrabble existence. He toils for 16 hours a day in a pickle factory and dreams of someday, you know, that his descendants will have a better lot in life. And then one day, he falls into a vat of pickles, and he gets brined for 100 years. The brine preserves him perfectly, so he doesn't age. He remains the same age, 27 years old, and he emerges in present-day Brooklyn, and he meets his great-great-grandson, me, Simon Rich, and moves in with me. And over the course of the story, we clash often.
He's disgusted by you, basically.
Yeah, he's completely horrified that all of his hard work and all of his dreams have come crashing down in the form of this frivolous Hollywood screenwriter.
Well, script doctor, you say, and he says, oh, you're a doctor. You say, well, not exactly.
Right, exactly. I had to break it to him. I'm not an actual medical doctor, but somebody who mainly adds gags to dog movies.
Well, but then he goes out and becomes a pickle salesman. He figures out how to create a pickling cart and sells pickles, but asks for the jar back. And everyone in Brooklyn, modern day Brooklyn, are so eco-friendly and in love with that sort of thing that they love him. And he gets written up in New York Magazine.
Right. Ironically, Herschel Rich, with his long, scraggly beard and his, you know, moth-picked clothes, he actually fits in perfectly with the hipster set in Williamsburg. So he ends up becoming a huge success, a way bigger success than I do.
And it is the one that I think is most about you or that you throw yourself into the most in Spoiled Brats. But why did you decide to write a book of stories about spoiled brats? Why were they on your mind and why were you one of them?
Good question. Yeah, it's definitely my most self-loathing book to date, I would say. You know, it's become sort of a postmodern trope to name the hero of a book after yourself. And I always thought it would be funnier and more honest to cast myself as the villain.
Because?
You know, this whole book was kind of a way to jolt myself into having perspective on my life. I think like a lot of people, sometimes I'll get really stressed about trivial problems. Sometimes if the internet isn't working at a Starbucks, I'll become so annoyed that I'll, you know, curse underneath my breath. and I'll lose perspective on all the insane privileges that I take for granted. And so I thought it would be funny to have a character like Herschel from the old world march into my living room and tell me off and tell me how silly I'm being.
I want to have you read a little bit from another one in which you are a villain, and it's the first story. If you can open up to page 4 of the
sure.
book and just give me a little bit of that. Yeah.
So this is this is the first story in the book. It's called Animals, and this one is from the perspective of a hamster in my third grade classroom. The hamster feeder for the week that's been assigned to take care of him is me, Simon Rich. So he's very scared about his fate. Because I tend to neglect my duties. And here's a little bit of him talking. My name is Princess Jasmine. I'm a male, so this name is humiliating, but I'm aware that my situation could be worse. The other homeroom, 2R, has a guinea pig named Stimpy and an elderly turtle named New Kids on the Block. My wife Pocahontas left me with 3 sons, and it's for their sake alone that I keep up my struggle. Every weekday morning, when the monsters run screaming through the door, I hide my babies under scraps of newspaper. Whenever food and water are scarce, I give them my whole portion. Their faces are exact replicas of my wife's, and when I look at them, it helps me remember just how beautiful she was. Their names are Big Mac, Whopper, and Mr. T.
And as I'm reading this, by the way, I'm wondering, at what point did he start to think about what the hamster in the classroom was thinking when he was in that classroom?
At what point did Simon
Simon Rich start to think
about it? Well, unfortunately
that?
For the hamsters, I certainly didn't think about it while I was there. I was too busy scarfing down cheese doodles and quoting popular sitcoms to notice them. And I think that's a lot of the thrust of the book is it's about the danger of losing perspective and the danger of getting so sucked up into your own solipsism that you forget to think about where other people are coming from.
You have been a writer on Saturday Night Live. You have published 2 novels, 4 short story collections. You're now in Canada working on a TV show. How do you like writing short stories compared with the other things that you do?
It's so much fun. I mean, a lot of my career has just been trying to rip off my heroes. And so I started writing stories just out of a desperate desire to imitate people like Roald Dahl and Shirley Jackson and T.C. Boyle. And I love them because they force you to be economical. They don't allow you to digress. Every sentence has to be really propulsive. And I find that the shorter the form, the higher the bar is.
I'm glad you brought up Roald Dahl because I saw that you had said that Roald Dahl and The Simpsons were your two chief influences.
Yeah, for sure. And that's been true for 20 plus years.
And do you remember the books that really turned you on to Roald Dahl?
The first one that really blew me away was The Twits. I just couldn't believe how transgressive it was and how nasty the characters were to each other. I couldn't believe that kind of behavior was allowed to occur in a book. But I loved all of his children's books, and then later I fell in love with his twist stories. Some of those collections, I think, to this day remain my favorites.
Simon Rich, his collection of short stories is called Spoiled Brats. Simon Rich, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
And a quick note now on yet another terrifying escaped bounce house, those huge inflatable rentable playhouses for kids. Maybe funny until they realized there were kids in it. 3 children were injured yesterday on a beach in Fort Lauderdale when the bounce house they were in was sent soaring into the air by a water spout, those rotating columns of water whipped by winds. The bounce house went above the tree line. It blew over 4 lanes of traffic. Now, the children were ejected, but 5-year-old Shadeza Bryant broke her wrist. Here she is on WSVN.
I was in a bounce house, and then the bounce house flew while I was in there. Then I fell in the dirt because I was about to die.
Ay, ay, ay. What is the deal with bounce houses? One was uprooted and launched into the air by a gust of wind in 2011, injuring 13 people on Long Island. Last May in upstate New York, 2 boys were hurt when they were thrown from another house. At the time, we spoke with John Lehman of the Post-Star newspaper in Glens Falls. A study found that every day in 2010, 31 children in the U.S. were treated in emergency rooms for injuries received inside bounce houses. Only one more dangerous backyard device exists, and that's the trampoline. So what are people there telling you about what, you know, somebody owned and everybody thought was a lot of fun?
Well, you know, we've spoken to some of the, you know, I have businesses that rent these products commercially, and they say there's a big difference between the ones you see at events, the commercial ones, which are regulated and insured and tested, and then you have these smaller ones that you can buy at any Target or Walmart. Gentleman we spoke with at one of these businesses said that he thinks the spikes are not sufficient to hold it to the ground in these situations, which appears to be the case in this incident here. He recommends getting some bigger spikes, you know, when you buy one of these things to ensure the safety.
Don Lehman in Glens Falls. And by the way, that bouncy house in Fort Lauderdale was secured to a basketball court, but the wind was so strong it snapped a concrete pole. Yeesh. In Cleveland right now, the Department of Justice is announcing terms of a settlement that would dictate terms for the city to reform its police department. Mayor Frank Jackson is calling it a transformative time.
Today, May 26, 2015, marks a new way of policing in the city of Cleveland, one built on a strong foundation of progressive change, sustained trust, and accountability.
The settlement comes in response to and months after that scathing report from the DOJ that found that police in Cleveland engaged in a pattern and practice of excessive and unnecessary force against civilians. And it comes just days after a white police officer was acquitted in the deaths of two unarmed black suspects in a car. And it's also the second time in about 10 years that the Cleveland Police Department has been scrutinized by the Department of Justice. Joe Worthy is with Here and Now contributor WCPN in Cleveland. He's a youth organizer with the Children's Defense Fund in Cleveland. Joe, we've got some notes here, what the settlement consists of. What are you hearing so far, and what are your thoughts?
Some of the things I'm hearing, what we were really concerned about is the citizen's role in policing, right? And the citizen's role in holding police accountable. And what we're hearing so far, it looks decent in terms of, you know, aesthetics, but we don't know how deep the transformation goes. So,
yeah. Well, we should say you are at our Here Now contributor WCPN, but you are an activist, so you come from that perspective. And we're hearing that some of the things agreed upon, a federal monitor will be appointed and a judge appointed to oversee the reforms. Civilian inspector general will be appointed by the mayor. Now, this we're also hearing that the police internal affairs division might be headed by a civilian. Your thoughts?
Again, a lot of these reforms that we're looking at, they have a timetable, right? And what we're concerned about is for long-term transformative change to happen, that there needs to be a group of independent folks that are able to hold the police accountable over the long term. In the event that they're able to do these reforms and get them done, you know, eventually those folks are going to leave, and they're going to leave the people of Cleveland behind. And that is really the big issue that the right. community is talking about. What we've been talking about from the beginning is not just having people come in to clean up, but having the citizens stay and be able to monitor police and have basically a fundamental shift in the power dynamics between citizens and police, especially in terms of when we're talking about the killing of 12-year-old boys.
Well, and you're referring to Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was waving around a fake gun, and after a call to 911, a police car pulled up. We've all seen the video, and he was shot and killed by a rookie cop. There's still decisions coming in that case. There's also the case of the mentally ill woman, Tanisha Anderson, killed when police used a restraint on her last year. She was face down on the sidewalk. And that DOJ report did find that the Cleveland police literally didn't know how to handle the mentally ill or scenes like the one with Tamir Rice. But you talk about wanting some kind of ongoing monitoring. We hear that in the run-up to the release of today's report that the city was asking for people to be volunteers, people who wanted to be one of those monitors. What happened with that?
I'm not sure or have heard of anything where the city was reaching out to people. And, I mean, my ear's pretty much to the ground 24/7. And the people that I've – that I'm talking to, including college professors, lawyers, and things like that, that are constantly monitoring this stuff, we've never heard of anything like that.
Yeah, so
and
we've
specifically asked the DOJ in their meeting, in the building, and the mayor specifically asked for that. And I would think if they were reaching out to community members to volunteer for that, that someone would have known that that was happening, and that's never come across my desk.
You haven't heard that. Well, Rob English with the Greater Cleveland Congregations says this agreement, the settlement would be a good first step if it includes provisions for what he called constitutional policing, better police training and money to back it all up. Let's listen.
We'll be looking for accountability, that there are timelines, benchmarks that have to be met. And if those aren't met, penalties to make sure that, and consequences to make sure that it moves forward.
And his group is marching right now as we speak. Right. It sounds as if everybody, that seems to be the major concern. How does this get carried out?
Yeah, that is the major concern. I mean, you know, the truth is this is the second time the DOJ has come in and told the city about itself. And we see where we're at now. That's why, at least in our camp, we are really focused on fundamentally shifting the power dynamic. When we fundamentally shift the power dynamics, then we have a constant sort of checks and balances between the community and the police so that these things can be met swiftly,
yeah.
You know, and beyond, you know, things like indictments and beyond things like, you know, verdicts. We're talking about guys who have killed people unnecessarily in the community's eyes are no longer in a uniform, period. We can't go in and, you know, tamper with juries or anything like that. But what we can do is make sure our people feel more comfortable in the streets that they're walking.
That's Joe Worthy, youth organizer with the Children's Defense Fund in Cleveland. As that city reaches a settlement with the Department of Justice after a scathing report about the city's police officers. Joe, we'll continue to follow this story. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.